Hi and welcome again to The Fourth Estate, Community Radio's program that delves into the media and communications industries. Hi, my name is Meg Caldwell and it's a pleasure to have you along for this week's show. Ahead on the program we talk sex, arts and censorship, plus we examine the issues of privacy on Twitter, so stick around with me over the next half hour for these stories and more. It's The Fourth Estate. Jim Anderson has had a brilliant, if not controversial, career as an artist and satirist. Since the 1960s, he has been challenging sexual censorship and homosexual prejudice through art, writing and the underground press. In London during this time, he became co-editor of the satirical Oz magazine and courted controversy with the establishment. His current exhibition, Lampoon, An Historical Art Trajectory, showcases over 40 years of his work. Jim Anderson talks to Angela Aldred about sex, politics and censorship.
First things I did with Oz was to produce a homosexual issue, and that caused a bit of a kerfuffle because the police, the issue sold out, we had two naked men on the front cover, and when the police realised it was two naked men, they tried to seize every issue, but it had sold out. It was a very popular issue, and they came round to the office and hauled me and Felix Dennis, the other editor, into Scotland Yard and gave us a finger-wagging and said, "Don't do that again, boys, and we'll do you." And, of course, a few issues later, we were done, and that was the famous or the infamous school kids issue. When we had invited, we were feeling Richard Neville, particularly, who was the main and the main editor of Oz, and the whole thing was his baby, really. He was feeling old and boring and wanted to get more in touch with the younger generation, and so he invited school kids to come and help edit an issue. And we put an ad in an earlier Oz to children to come and, if you're under 18, come and help us. And so 20 kids turned up, and we said, "Look, go away, write what you want, draw what you want, do whatever you want, bring it back in a couple of weeks, and we will publish it. We won't censor you, and it'll be your issue. It'll be a regular issue of Oz, but it'll be, you know, influenced by you."
So you didn't believe in censoring anybody or anything
in
Oz?
No, I'm always basically against censorship. I mean, there are some difficult areas, but back then, I mean, what was being censored was sort of absurd, really. I mean, the establishment was a very conservative establishment, and there have been lots of struggles in the field of literature, really, like the Lady Chatterley's case, and there have been a few battles won. But Oz was never regarded as literature, it was a magazine, and so we were fair game. There was a thing called the Underground Press in London back in the 60s, which was very, very powerful, and Oz was like the flagship of the Underground Press in a way. There was lots of tabloid Underground Press. We were sort of like a magazine with colour and very, very widely circulated and very popular. The establishment, which is what we call the conservative government at the time, wanted to stop us. But there's no way that it could stop publishing, but they could get us through the obscenity laws. And so when we produced the school kids issue, some rather startling imagery, I must say, and some from the school kids, and they gave them an opportunity to stop us. So they, first of all, the charges with obscenity and publishing indecent material, two very, very minor charges. The school kids came in with their terrific stuff, and we put it all in the magazine, but they didn't give us enough to fill a whole magazine, because Oz has got 48 pages, and so we had several empty pages, and so we had no cover. The school kids had all gone home for the night. We had to get to the printer in the morning, so what to do? So we had this, somebody had given us this semi-erotic sort of magazine called Erotic Designs from a French artist called Bertrand. And the kids had all seen this on the coffee table in my flat as they were putting the issue together, and they all liked it and giggled over it. And anyway, it's a long story, but because we had nothing else. It was a single female figure, naked in various pleasurable poses. Not remotely pornographic, but coupled with the fact that it was called School Kids Issue, with a picture of a school kid on the cover as well as the typified naked blue lesbians, it just, the shit hit the fan, frankly, and we were busted almost immediately, because headmasters all over England sort of hit, you know, kids loved it, and anyway, we were busted, and Richard, who was in Ibiza having a holiday, had no idea we'd put this on the cover. He was summoned back immediately, and he accepted responsibility for the issue, even though he'd been away. And so that was the beginning of it. We were given a year to prepare for the trial. I never saw it as any big deal. I thought the attitude of the authorities was a bit indecent materials, as opposed to very minor charges. But because of the political situation in England at that time, the Conservative government got in, they decided to up the ante, and they went back to an old common law offence called conspiracy to corrupt public morals. And we were charged with conspiracy to corrupt public morals and to implant in the minds of children of the realm lustful and perverted desires, which is very, very serious. It could carry life imprisonment. So that was the beginning of what became eventually the Oz conspiracy and the obscenity trial a year later, which has sort of gone down in history and has never left me, really. But it was a landmark in terms of at least censorship, and it changed the attitude towards censorship forever in England, for the better.
Do you think that there would be anything that would evoke that kind of charge today?
Not really. There's been a few. What about Julian Assange? I mean, there's an interesting thing. There's a remote parallel with Oz, because Oz was concerned with the politics of the situation back in the 60s. You know, they used the obscenity laws for political purposes to stop the underground press and everything that the underground press represented: anti-Vietnam War, pro-marijuana, pro-psychedelic drugs, and all those sort of things. So they wanted to stop us. Now, with Julian Assange, they want to stop him because he is democratizing, he's making things available for everybody, which, you know, governments like to keep a bit secret. But it's also, I mean, more openness the better. I mean, if it sort of makes diplomats quail in their shoes a little bit, I don't care. Yeah. But what's interesting is it's also involved with sexuality, Julian Assange, particularly the really absurd laws about rape, what constitutes rape in Sweden. I mean, I don't like the devaluation of the word rape, which is one of the most serious offences and crimes you can commit, right up there with murder. But to call not using a condom with somebody with whom you've already had consensual sex, to call that rape is a bit absurd. And I think the Swedish government should look again at the way they're looking at their laws. I mean, it's sort of ridiculous.
People kind of use their reticence towards sexuality and things like channel porn, kind of really hot topics that are validly kind of fearful, like rape and child pornography, to kind of censor other information like Oz and Julian Assange.
Yes, that's where the political thing comes in. Yes, I agree with you. It is like that. And so that's what we have to guard against, I think. I'm an artist, and I like to, you know, I am interested in sexuality. I was very influenced by Robert Crumb, who absolutely extraordinary artist, and Robert Hughes called him the Goya of the underground press. And he broke all the sexual taboos about what you could draw and paint. And he was very influential on me when I was the art editor of Oz magazine. So I've continued in that vein. I've always had an interest in sexual imagery, on erotic imagery. And I show, every year I show things in concert with Mardi Gras, like gay sort of imagery. And I've never sort of felt a need to restrict myself, and because I'm painting or collaging for a gay audience. But with my new show at the Tinsheds Gallery, I was a little bit concerned about not offending people by showing in a regular gallery, I guess involved with the University of Sydney, some of my more extreme gay imagery. And so I did, in fact, do a little self-censorship. I didn't show my more extreme gay imagery. I did show some, but not the most outrageous sort of ones. So I censored myself, and I knew my family were going to be there, and I didn't want them to be upset, so I was a little bit careful. You know, censorship, it's everywhere, really. Self-censorship, I mean, that can be taken to extremes as well. You have to be a bit brave.
That was Jim Anderson speaking to Angela Aldred for the Fourth Estate, and the retrospective exhibition of Jim Anderson's work is on at Sydney University's Tin Sheds Gallery until March the 12th. Back in the day, it was the Beastie Boys who said you had to fight for your right to party. And all these years later, the legacy lives on in media businessman Andrew WK. Thrust into the spotlight back in 2001 with his musical LP debut, I Get Wet, the guy has become a self-made prophecy, touring the US in evangelical whites to spread the party word as a motivational speaker. Lately, there's been a lot of hype surrounding the pedestal we place celebrities on when it comes to endorsing, with the likes of Shane Warne under fire for inadvertently promoting obesity. In the case of Andrew WK, the product, however, is simply himself, with a finger inserted in all holes in the media pie, with stakes in a record label and a television production company, as well as hosting TV shows such as Ask Andrew WK and Destroy, Build, Destroy. Here recently to psych Australians up for the year, which includes for him an impending album release and a book deal, denoting his time as a pseudo-evangelist, I spoke to the modern man's Rupert Murdoch, firstly with a comparison to the media mogul, which pleased him greatly.
I would love to have some of Rupert Murdoch's skills. He is certainly someone to model.
You can't really kind of do your curriculum vitae in, you know, a single breath. There's the kind of, you know, even your Destroy, Build, Destroy show, which I think most little boys would just think is the ideal kind of premise. It's like you get to blow stuff up and then you rebuild stuff.
Yes, Destroy, Build, Destroy. This is a TV show that actually, of course, we make it in the U.S. It's on a channel there called Cartoon Network.
I think we get that on Foxtel.
Yeah, this is what's so amazing, because the only other country right now that broadcast this is Australia, and I thought that was so fantastic. And it's a relatively new show. I mean, we're actually about to start filming our third season. It's done very well in the U.S. I hope it's doing well here. And like you said, I think a young person of any age, really, I mean, if you have a youthful sense of wonder in your body at all, you're going to appreciate this. It's me, I mean, a rock and roll dude, long hair, screaming his head off through a megaphone while explosions and monster trucks and football players and teenagers with bazookas. I mean,
I guess I get a little bit, you know, into this idea, because you do seem to take quite a prophetic take on music itself. You know, you've been involved in this project, The Zen of Screaming, as well as the fact that you drew from the idea that you really bolster quite an energy that could be really worked with in an inspirational sense.
I hope so. I mean, I want to use every method to get across a feeling of joy. And joy to me actually isn't even like happiness necessarily. It's more just this energy of life. It's beyond emotion. It's beyond happy or sad. It's beyond positive or negative. It's just raw energy. And music, entertainment, conversation like we're doing right now, any way that you can express an idea has the ability to cause energy to be created. And then someone can use that energy and harness it and put it towards whatever they want to do, anything in their life. And that's what I feel like I'm here to do, make energy that people can use for their own happiness.
Right. And you have gone on to do that. You had an MTV show where you actually, you know, asked Andrew W. Case.
Okay, because I'm here to get, we want to, again, support each other. We're all trying to feel as good as we can all the time. And that's my mission, is to help us all do that together.
But with that, does there come a bit of a responsibility or a duty of care that concerns you?
I mean, I suppose so, but that's the trade-off. I mean, if you take this stuff seriously in that you care about how people feel, then yeah, there is an amount of pressure, but it's a good kind of pressure. It's a good kind of a challenge. It's a good kind of mission to be on. And anything that's worth doing is not necessarily going to be very easy. But again, there's so many people that I have with me, whether they're my business partners, my band, my friends and family, or anyone that believes in this, that I don't have to do it all on my own. And that's probably the most important thing, that this is a team effort. This is a team of partiers living each day with a full-blown attitude.
And how the attitude is spread. I mean, you are all for the idea of the power of thinking, really. You say all this idea that, you know, if you think about the moment where you thought about the moment where you would be thinking back on that moment, and then
yeah,
it's like you can make that happen.
It does feel a little weird. But
yeah, well, this is kind of, you know, the way I get, you know, it's obviously quite a convoluted idea being inside your head, but I mean,
well, I hope you like it in there. That is a fun sensation, and that may be a very good way to illustrate existence in general, is thinking about thinking about thinking about thinking about partying.
Yeah, and yet there's a certain grain of salt philosophy that one must take on with you a bit as well.
Well, I want people to enjoy themselves. So however they want to take it, as long as it feels good, that's the right way to think about it. There's no right way to understand what I do. You can take it any way you want. I have no rules, because that just gets stressful to me. The whole idea of partying is there is no rule. There's no right thing to do or wrong thing to do. It's whatever makes you feel good, and as long as it doesn't stand in the way of someone else's joy, then you're good to go. I would never tell anyone how to think or how to act or how to have fun. It's all about what you want.
Oh, so I guess a cult isn't on the cards then. I was thinking maybe that was the next step up, because you do kind of have that look about you of the evangelical man. You know, you all wear, get your whites on, and, you know, there is a notion of this is one man, he's got an aura.
If it was to be a cult, then it would be a cult where everybody gets to do whatever they want to do anyway. So, I mean,
That's the anti-cult.
It could work, though.
To be taken with a liberal grain of salt, that was musician and evangelist Andrew W.K. Well, streaming across the digital airwaves could now find you anywhere from the zoo to the crack to the likes of good old Barry. And these are just a handful of the colourful assortment of titles making up some 18 new digital broadcast-only networks. Since the big DAB, or digital radio rollout, Australia has seen good returns, but coverage remains limited to the likes of metropolitan areas, and trials still remain at the government's discretion. A recent publication by UK radio expert Grant Goddard paints a much bleaker picture. Entitled DAB, Digital Radio, Licence to Fail, it's a detailing of what he alleges to be the unfolding of a secret government deal between itself and commercial radio in an attempt to phase out analogue for good. Local industry expert Steve Ahern says this is a cynical outlook, and essentially similar decisions have been made here between government and broadcasters, and we serve to prove as an exemplary working model.
Tuesday, 23rd November, 1773.
In three, Australians believe that humans and dinosaurs coexisted.
You're with Future Tense. New ideas, new approaches, new technologies. Available online at ABC.
So I'm a dad now. Yeah. No need for that, it was an accident.
Deals were done between regulators, government, and the industry to try and encourage the industry to get onto digital radio and to protect the industry's interests in return. And I don't see anything wrong with a deal like that, because without it, I think we'd still be waiting for digital radio in this country. So I reckon deals that are mutually beneficial to the audience, to the government, and to the stations themselves are not a bad thing at all. It's pragmatic and realistic.
And in fact, since Australia has had digital radio available for purchase, I believe it's just passed over the year mark, the sales have far exceeded the expectations, and it's for only metropolitan cities. It's amazing how many people are listening to digital radio on a weekly basis.
It is, and it's a really heartening thing. The industry wants to put more stations on air so they can get more revenue, and the government wants more channels and more choices and better quality listening for people. And I reckon the way that Australia has shaped up as a result of the deals done here is a great example of how to do it anywhere in the world. In fact, part of the work I do these days is exactly that, going around to other countries and talking about how we've done it here and helping them develop models of how they might introduce digital radio and TV in their countries.
There have been a couple of problems within that industry body. ACMA recently granted an exemption for digital-only stations to fulfil a minimum Australian local content quota. What do you make of that?
Well, I think if that was something permanent, that would have been a mistake, but it's clear that it's not. It's an exemption while stations get themselves up and running. Australian Content Quota is all about returning money to Australian artists so they can make a living out of their creativity, and that's a good thing. But at the moment, the digital radio stations are not making any money. They've invested a lot to get started, and so far there's not much revenue coming in. So if they had to pay an extra additional license fee without any real new cash flow at this early stage, then that may not be fair.
Do you own a digital radio yourself?
I have four of them in my place.
Is there one in your car? Because we call it the drive slot for a reason. It's fundamental to that habit-forming thing of radio.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I think that that's a current weakness in the market and that it has to be addressed, because digital radios in cars is the next, I would say, main focus. Now, do I have one in my car? Yes. I bought one of the few car attachment models. Probably the heartening piece of news that's happened in the last 6 months is that in France they perceived the same problem, and they've actually made a law that forces all car manufacturers who are manufacturing in France to put digital radios in their production line cars from, I think it's next year.
But Steve, I think it's interesting because you really do sound excited about where it's going, and you've had, you know, quite a lengthy career in radio broadcasting. So, I mean, is this an unprecedented kind of turning point for radio, or is it only going to strengthen? Where's it at, do you think?
Well, I think it's part of what I would call a multi-platform strategy for radio. Radio's got to go digital, but if we depended just on digital radio, all the stuff we've been talking about, that probably wouldn't be enough to position radio into the new media world strongly. But if radio businesses think about their product first, you know, what they put on air, make sure that's really good, and then they think of delivering it on all the platforms that people are consuming now, and that's digital radio, that's the internet, and all the sort of things that are around now and are coming, then the strategy becomes clear. You have to push out your signal in a digital form, and that digital form has to be suitable for all those digital devices that are around. So I am excited about digital radio, but I'm not silly enough to think that that alone is going to be something that takes the radio industry into its next century.
Radio industry expert, that was Steve Ahern. Brings us to the end of another Fourth Estate. Time now to offer our appreciation to the Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences at Macquarie University, as well as the Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences at the University of Technology Sydney for financial support. And the social media presence is back and better than ever. With all engines firing, do catch us on the 4thestateradio.blogspot.com page, or go to 4thestate.podomatic.com and subscribe to the podcast. So that's it for me, Mig Caldwell. Until next week, I do look forward to joining you again for more stories on our media and communications industries.